This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our candid and enlightening conversation today with 94-year-old World War II Army Air Corps veteran Jack Leonard of Clovis, California, originally from Casper, Wyoming, where he grew up as the son of Polish immigrants. Jack and his three brothers all served in World War II. We've heard how a change in assignment sent him to Camp Pinedale in Fresno, where he met his wife of 70 years. We even heard a little bit from her, and I wish we would have recorded the interview that Jack's son Scott did with him in front of high school and junior high students at Fresno Christian. I do have a link at hometownheroesradio.com to the coverage of that event by Fresno Christian's award-winning online newspaper, The Feather. Check that out. The bond, though, between father and son, the mutual love and respect that they have is so impressive, so palpable. And Scott did a better job interviewing his dad than I ever could. Scott wouldn't be here. He and his three brothers would have never been born if Jack didn't come home from the war. You can say the same for Jack and Maxine's 9 grandkids and their 5 great-granddaughters. When we left off, Jack told us about the day a Japanese soldier found his way into their outpost, actually fired shots into the office that Jack would have normally occupied, but also shot and wounded one of the Nisei soldiers, the Japanese Americans under Jack's command. You said you applied first aid and you rushed him to the hospital, and as it turned out, he lost a whole lot of blood. Why don't you pick up the story right there?
He had to have a transfusion. All the Nisei wanted to give him their blood, but I was a commanding officer. And I had the same type of blood. So someplace in Minneapolis, there is a young, there's a Japanese family that has a pint of Polish blood in them.
Well, that's a great story. And I'm sure every time you tell it, you get the same kind of reaction. People don't see that coming.
Where were you when World War II came to an end? When you found out, hey, this is all over, our side won, and I get to go home and see if that young lady I was married to for a few weeks is still there.
Well, as I said, I was down in Brisbane on a rest leave. And the day before the war ended, we were at the air base ready to take off, and our plane developed engine trouble. So we couldn't take off until the next day. Well, my 21 men wanted to stay there. Then we didn't want to go to the barracks. They wanted to go downtown and have a free night because we're going back to the war. And I said, okay, if you'll be here at 7:30 in the morning, I'll let you go. And I went to the officer's quarters and got my room back and sacked out. Well, that night the war ended. And when the war ended, I thought, well, I wonder who's going to show up. Who's going to show up in the morning, because Brisbane went just like San Francisco and every place else in the world, went just hog wild. In the morning when I got to the airbase at 7:30, or it was up at 7:29 when I got there in the Jeep, 21 guys were lined up waiting for me. They were ready to go home. We had to fly back to Leyte, where our headquarters was. We had to stop at Biak, the island of Biak, for that was the air base. We had to stop the fuel. Well, we had a heck of a time trying to land at Biak because they were shooting off AK-AK, the tracers, celebrating the end of the war. So they had to finally get them to stop shooting so we could land and get gas. But we got back, and from then on, we played a lot of gin, a lot of bridge, a lot of poker, and just waited till we got home. I'd been in the service from 1940, so I had quite a few points, so I got out. I left Manila in November of the 30th, 1945.
And what do you remember about being back home in California and seeing your bride again?
Well, I was out of my mind. I'm where I belong. But here I am. I have no talent. I'm 6 years in the service. And how good is cryptanalysis in civilian life? Maxine's father was a general contractor. While I was overseas, they bought a lot, and the first thing we had to do was build a house. Well, I couldn't even hold a hammer. I didn't know how to hold a hammer. Well, he taught me how to hold a hammer, and I was a carpenter. I worked as a carpenter, worked with him, and built a house. And now I had to do a job, and I didn't know what I was going to do. I knew I didn't want to be a carpenter. Her father thought maybe he could bring me along and go into the business with him, but I didn't think I would suited for that. He didn't either. After he knew me, he learned well. And I took a aptitude test. Minnesota Mutual gave aptitude tests. Well, being that I had no training except military, it was just aptitude based on personality. Well, it came back, and the operator, or the agent for Minnesota Mutual, called me in and said, we got your test back. It came back very good. You're very good at mathematics. You're very good at analysis. But you want to get a job where you don't deal with people, because you don't like people at all. And definitely don't want, he was looking for salesmen. But at the same time, he did say that they're hiring temporary people at Producers Cotton Oil Company. Well, I went down and applied, and I got the job as a temporary clerk. I reported to work one morning, and I never worked as a temporary clerk because a young man that had a job that happened to be the superintendent of sales and shipping for the mill department of Producers Cotton Oil Company, had quit. And the secretary treasurer, office manager of the company said he thought I would, I could fit that job and it would be a permanent job. So I didn't know what I was going to do, but I found out that I'm in sales. And I was told not to be in sales.
Right. You're not a people person.
I'm not a people person. The first person that people walked into the office that they saw besides a switchboard operator was me, because I was right at the front door. Anyhow, I stayed with him for 18 years, and then I decided to become an attorney.
God always has a plan, and he has a sense of humor, I guess, too, huh?
I guess he does. I always ask him every morning, what does he want me to do? And he doesn't tell me anything. But at nighttime, I say, thank you. I'll see you tomorrow morning. I thank him for the day.
I want to ask you before I forget. We mentioned earlier that you were one of four brothers who all served in World War II. What were your other brothers doing during the war? And did you ever have any idea of what they were up to?
One underneath me, the one that's still surviving, he was in the Navy. The two younger ones were enlisted men in the Navy. My oldest brother was a fighter pilot, and he was killed in just 3 days before the war ended in Europe, in Italy.
When did you find out about that, that he had been killed just a few days before the war in Europe was over?
I got a letter from my sister-in-law, his wife. I was in Brisbane, and she told me about it.
What did that feel like? How devastating was that for you?
Well, my brother and I were fairly close. We were only a year and 9 months apart. We were only a year apart in school. And he was my idol. I wanted to do everything he did. So it was quite devastating to me at the time. I realized what he was doing, but it was going to happen. But why did it have to happen to him? Why did God pick him? But God picked a lot of people. But it was pretty devastating to lose someone. I felt sorry for myself. I lost my brother.
The way I understand it, you had an opportunity this last year to visit Washington, D.C. and the National World War II Memorial. Your son, Scott, went with you. And as part of that tour, you guys were looking at a particular airplane at a particular museum. And it just so happened that there was a connection between that plane and your brother's service in World War II. And you didn't find that out until that trip? Tell me how that all unfolded.
Oh, we knew before the trip. We knew about what he had done. We knew that he was one of the first to shoot down a German jet. I knew that. My sister-in-law told me that. Uh-huh. He went to a command conference in Rome, and knew that he was a good fighter pilot. And he did his share.
And I know you learned the circumstances of his death. That on a mission to hit the Ploiesti oil fields in Romania, his P-51 was hit. His wingmen warned him not to bail out because he was too close to the ground. But he tried to, and his chute never opened. But while you're in Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight, you happen to see something that you hadn't seen before, thanks to your son, your nephew, and some technology perhaps a little more advanced than those little cylindrical code machines you were using during World War II.
Got a picture of the Italian paper. I have a picture of my brother and four or five other pilots that shot down jets that day. My brother was the first, and these four of them shot jet. And there's a picture, and here's a picture of my brother up in the corner of it, being the first. I got that picture through my son.
Well, and that's what I was alluding to, because you and your son did a phenomenal job sharing this story with the students at Fresno Christian School, and I was there to listen to all of that. And your son Scott said, here you guys are at the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., looking at an ME-262, that German jet. Your brother shot down one of those planes in World War II. And so your son texts his cousin, who he's never met, and your cousin fires back with that article that you're talking about. So there's proof and verification. That seems pretty surreal to be standing in that place and get that on the smartphone at that point.
It is. It is surreal. How it happens, I don't know. But you know what? The communications are so fast today that it's mind-boggling. I'm a dinosaur when it comes to communications.
And I allude to that experience with the ME-262 and your brother's legacy. But I'm sure that wasn't the only time you thought about your brother on that trip. You're with all these other veterans as part of Central Valley Honor Flight, but the main destination was the World War II Memorial. When you looked at that wall of gold stars representing over 400,000 Americans who didn't come home, and knowing that your brother was one of those represented there, what did that feel like? What did that mean to you to be there and see that?
My brother is one of those gold stars. Thank the good Lord, I'm not there. My brother was not as safe as I was, wasn't granted the life I was, unfortunately. But that's about it. That was a long time ago. That's in the past. So far back, 70 years ago. I still have the love for my brother that I had when he was alive. But it's not the sharp, instant feeling, instantaneous feelings or memories that you have. Not now.
What did that whole honor flight experience mean to you? What did you get out of it?
I got that the people of the United States are just wonderful, wonderful people out of that flight. The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful. They aren't what you hear on the negative sides of the news and TV. People are great. We walked through the airport in Baltimore, and people that are waiting at the gates would come out and applaud and come out and shake our hands and say, thank you for your service. The tears would flow, I tell you. They didn't flow very fast, but man, these people, they don't even know us. And here are 67 of us with our guardians and our staff going through this airport. And it was from here to Save Mart that we had to walk. It was a heck of a long distance to get to our buses. The people were just fantastic. And then our first stop was in Baltimore. And in Baltimore, the Post 40 of the American Legion put on a barbecue dinner for us. Well, they had a man put the barbecue dinner on. He had 11 barbecue restaurants in Baltimore. Well, after the American Legion goes through their rigmarole, their rituals, and introduce everybody, we have our dinner, and they introduce him. And he comes up, and he says he has 11 restaurants. We're going to 14 more. But he says, I'll tell you, without you gentlemen, you 67 people, we would be speaking Japanese and German. He says, I'll tell you what I do. Every day at noon, I close my restaurants, including my kitchens, and play the national anthem. Well, now, when that reach you, the first thing you get off the plane and have dinner, and someone tells you that, you know it's an upper. And then we get to the hotel that night, and then the next day we go to the World War II Museum, where our three congressmen are there, and it's vacation time, and the kids are all over. We walked as a group, and there were school kids in going from one memorial to another, and they were all lined, and you could see their guardians holding them over. They break ranks. The kids would break ranks and come over, and they would hug us and thank us. Just absolutely, they wouldn't stay there. They wanted to thank us and shake our hands. Kids, 8, 9, 10, 12 years old. And this happened all over Washington, no matter where we were. We were greeted as though we were something special. The smiles and the happiness of theirs and their thanks. But a strange thing happened personally. First generation American. Parents are from Poland. Well, at the changing the guard at the Arlington Cemetery, the sergeant major says they dedicate a wreath. Well, the day that we were there, they dedicated the wreath to their Polish defenders. Well, that's good. My ancestors. Yeah. So then the next day we're walking from the Vietnam to the Korean memorials. And this lady comes out of the crowd. They did quite frequently, but she came out and she grabbed my hands. And she shook and she said, I got to thank you for saving my country. I'm here from Latvia. Well, the coincidental thing is, my mother was born in Riga, Latvia.
How about that?
Now, if you think someone wasn't guiding her to come see me out of all 67 of those guys, why me? Because my mother was born in Riga, Latvia.
I think if folks have been paying close attention to your story from start to finish, they're sensing a lot of those moments here. Your orders get changed. You end up in Fresno. You meet your wife. You're sleeping instead of in your office when the gunman comes in. Right down the line, it does seem like a lot of things lined up. And you've mentioned that you feel it's God, and you've mentioned your faith that you share with your wife. But you haven't mentioned how long it took you to figure all that out. And this is a story that your son helped share at that event that I got to be a part of. How do you tell that story of how you came to the faith that you have now?
Well, I was reared a Roman Catholic. I was an altar boy. I sang Granada's Ave Maria in the 1939 Midnight Mass. But I always had a question. Not quite a doubting Thomas, but I questioned, well, who was Jesus Christ? I questioned that. And I did practically all of my life. I knew God controlled everything. But I wasn't sure about Jesus. Well, Scott is an ordained minister and very, very, very strict Christian. But he doesn't try to force that on us at all. My son Scott, he doesn't try to force it on. We're very close to Scott. I am. He's my best friend. Anyhow, he didn't do it. No one did it. But one morning, I'm 75 years old. I woke up one morning. Someone touched me. Nothing untoward or spectacular happened. I just woke up and realized the only way to heaven or to eternal life is through Jesus Christ. It just struck me. And I can tell you, it changed my life, and Maxine will agree, it changed me. Why it happened, I have no idea, but God touched me. When he's ready, that's what I say. I'd like to know what day it is in that book when he's going to take me, but I really don't. But there are, our day is written, and when he wants us, he'll take us. And I don't worry about it.
I can tell you're having too much fun. Why worry, huh?
I'm having a ball. We came back from World War II. We didn't expect anything. We expected all we wanted to do was just go out and do our job, get a job and go to work. That's all we felt. We didn't expect anything from anyone. And now, 70 years later, we're getting the honor flight.
Yeah, is there anything else you want to say about that? Because I'm sure, you know, you might run into a neighbor who's a veteran and says, ah, is that thing for real? Should I really think about going on that, or is that some kind of racket? How do you answer a question like that?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the honor flight is about one of the best honorable recognitions to give to World War II veterans right now. Every World War II veteran should go. If he gets the opportunity, he should look into it. Because they find that the people of the United States do respect what we did in World War II. And it shows in Washington, D.C. That flight made me realize that the people of the United States are just a whole group of great, great, great people.
Well, people like you set a really great example. Jack Leonard, 94 years young, thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. I know that story has a few chapters yet to be written. Don't forget to check out the photos of Jack and Maxine on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page or on hometownheroesradio.com. We're out of time for now. I hope you'll join us again next time. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.